Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Is that the end of this case?
How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Start with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all next.
Welcome to episode 91 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. It was a slow week for argued cases, but as we'll cover, a pretty busy week for decided cases.
Busier than we've had in quite a while. The third segment's going to be decided cases.
That's right, because we only have the two cases. And because of the two cases, our first case today will actually be a COVID-19 case. It was argued in the Seventh Circuit last week, Windy City Limousine versus Cincinnati Insurance. An interesting case about automobiles, and we'll get into the details. Litchfield argued for Cincinnati, as he does at all appellate level cases so far on this issue. The second case is Blaha versus City of Chicago from the Illinois Appellate First District. And in that case, the appellant opened with, "We are asking this court to thread a very fine needle."
That's
Windy City. I'm sorry. And that's the title of this episode. We were asking this court to thread a very fine needle into a strong headwind. We'll get into that. I apologize. Blaha is actually a case involving a statute, and as we've talked about it many times in the show, kind of the inconsistencies or potential inconsistencies between provisions, and an interesting argument. In any event, again, we are asking this court to thread a very fine needle into a strong headwind was the opening line of the oral argument of counsel for plaintiff, appellant, insured, Windy City Limousine Company, before the Seventh Circuit in a COVID-19 business interruption case last week, in which the client sued Cincinnati Insurance Company. Windy City sued for business interruption as a result of COVID-19 and claimed damage as a result of both the shutdown of its office and its vehicles. It further argued that the term property damage is defined in the liability portion of the policy, and that should apply to provide a definition of damage to property and the first party property portion of the policy. Pat, with that, tell us about oral argument in this case.
Thanks, Dan. I'm sure folks have gotten kind of sick of us talking about COVID-19 insurance coverage cases, but we keep there are the opportunity to talk about a lot of aspects of insurance, and there hasn't been a bigger, more high profile insurance coverage issue in my recollection ever. I mean, there's been, you know, in the insurance world, there may have been bigger ones, but one that the public is aware of and where people are following it and has such a broad impact.
That's hard
to imagine one.
The only things that even come close, I would think, would be pollution back in the 70s and 80s, but that probably didn't have the same, we're in a different era, and it probably didn't have the public's kind of focus.
Right, and the other one would have been the World Trade Center, whether it was one occurrence or two, but that was, you know, one very limited, large though it was, to be sure, issue. So in this case, on rebuttal, but in counsel for appellee's argument, which Dan said was argued by Dan Litchfield of the Litchfield Cavo firm, who has represented Cincinnati in at least three oral arguments that we've covered for Cincinnati in the Eighth Circuit, and forget the other one that he argued that we've covered, but this one as well in the Seventh. Maybe it's another one in the Seventh Circuit. In fact,
maybe
I think it was Sandy Point.
Sandy Point was also
Mr. Litchfield. So he really gave a masterclass in policy construction, because counsel, as Dan mentioned, was trying to argue that the definition of property damage from the liability portion of the policy should tell us what damage to property should mean in the first party portion of the policy. So there are different parts of the policy. They have different definitions. The definition of one, it's typically what happens is the definition says these are the definitions for this part of the policy. Doesn't mean it applies to any other part of the policy. Counsel tried to argue, well, it's the contract as a whole. Well, no, the contract as written says just this part of the policy. That's all this definition applies to. It doesn't apply outside of that context. And the very fine needle and the very strong headwind that they're up against are all of the Seventh Circuit cases. Sandy Point is the best example of that. But also the recent decision from the Seventh Circuit involving Houston Casualty, which was the theater case, that there was a, whether they're applying North Carolina or Illinois law, kind of put a nail in the coffin. I think, as Judge Sykes said, this is kind of over. But they are, you know, making their argument. They got a job to do. And the other part of the argument that was very interesting, and the part that Litchfield started off with, was, well, they're arguing for shutdown of their vehicles. Well, right. Let me deal with that very quickly, he says, because the vehicles are specifically excluded from the first party property coverage. And that's a different policy. It's right out of the policy. You know, Windy City Limousine, for those that aren't familiar, is a very large, as the name suggests, limousine company. They provide party buses and limousines and other, you know, black cars that transport folks in the city for a variety of purposes. I think my wife and I used them for a limousine for our wedding. They're a big company here
very large.
In Chicago. Very large. They do a great job. But they had both a shutdown of their office facilities as well as their large fleet of automobiles,
right? You know, nobody limousines, was driving.
Party buses, so forth.
Nobody was going anywhere in the early days of the pandemic.
No, and obviously
no travel, no weddings, no anything.
Right, and so the question is: is this accepted from the property coverage? And Litchfield's like, yeah, it's specifically excluded. If you want coverage for your vehicles, then you got to look at a different policy that covers autos. And we've talked about before where you have CGL coverage covers, you know, on the liability side, there's an automobile exclusion. And we talked about it last week, in fact, right, with regards to the flagger and whether it's covered under the automobile policy or the CGL policy. Those are different policies. Likewise, there's similar different policies for property damage to autos. Autos are a different risk than other kinds of business personal property. And they're a very particular kind of risk, and companies treat them differently. So they've got a very difficult road to hoe. They're going to keep trying to do it, as we're going to talk about in the third segment. The first of the Supreme Courts of the states have come down and ruled in favor of the insurers. There were three decisions this week in that regard. So we've got the law continues to march on, nary a dissent in sight. We'll see if this one goes anywhere, but I have my doubts, considering both how the policy is written and how they've already ruled, the Seventh Circuit has, on these issues. And there was one other thing. There was a reference in here to the very large string cite that Cincinnati included, right, with, here's all the cases pages that say it goes on for pages. Now, I went back and grabbed their brief because I wanted to see how long was the string cite. I was able to find it. It wasn't quite five pages, and it was kind of broken up into different parts, but there was some very long string cites with, here's all the cases that say we're right on this. So that's... you know, string cites are frowned upon, but what else are they going to do? They want to show the weight of authority is in their favor because that's a great argument. You know, both the Seventh Circuit as well as other courts, you should have interpreted this uniformly. The court pointed it out. Why not point it out in your brief? Best way to do that, just list all the cases for the court. Dan, anything else to add on this case? This case is great because of the opening line. That's it just is. That you can't beat that line. Counsel acknowledging he's got a problem.
The only thing I would say, Pat, is, again, we've talked about this, that there have been some pleadings that have gone through motion to dismiss that do argue that there's physical loss or damage. And I do think, you know, when we look on LinkedIn, you and I are both on these kind of chains. I think policyholder side and the insurer side are a bit surprised by the uniformity that even in cases where there might be some well-pleaded facts, you know, the 12B6 is supposed to be taken on its face, right? And if there's a credible, then it gets past the motion to dismiss. And then there's still an uphill battle, as we talked about. And that's not really occurring in this case like it did in other arenas we talked about. That's one thing. I also think that these string sites, it's all those are persuasive potentially, right? I mean, the only cases that would affect the Seventh Circuit would be Seventh Circuit cases, although I get why insurers are doing that. But that's just one of the oddities here is that it's been so uniform so quickly. And as you mentioned, we're going to talk about the first highest Supreme Court. You know, we listened to oral arguments in that case. We didn't, you know, there was some discussion about this kind of getting past the motion to dismiss. I think maybe one other court at the highest court has asked those kinds of questions. Wisconsin kind of hinted at it. But you know, until we see, or we may never see any highest state court come to it. I think Steve Shulwolf, who we've had on the show, has still taken a position as a mediator that he expects at least one state somewhere to veer. So we'll see. But it's not looking good for this thinly the head of a needle, or it's, you know, the how many angels dance on the head of a pin type of argument. You know, it's going to be very difficult to for any policyholder to be successful all the way through on these cases.
I push back a little bit and simply say that when you're dealing with a federal court, whether it's a district court or a circuit court, on an issue of state law like this, they are not bound. Hell, they're not, whether it's an issue of federal law, they're not bound by anything. Their own decisions, the only thing they're bound by is the United States Supreme Court. And I don't see that. I don't see that. We've talked about this. We don't see them weighing in on this issue. So you want to give them as much weight as you can, as much authority as you can. Say, don't change your mind now.
Sure.
And also, there is predictability and uniformity is important in contract interpretation, especially when all of these policies use essentially the same language in the insuring agreement. Physical damage or physical damage to or loss of, you know, this kind of a language where every policy is using this. If there's uniformity, then that's good for everybody in the long run. It may not be good for policyholders in this particular circumstance.
Or other circumstances. But, again, when you look at other policyholder, again, language interpretations at the state level, right? There's 50 states. And again, that would be my only pushback to your pushback is that, you know, there are differences in how, you know, for example, the Montrose Doctrine in California, or, you know, Peppers in Illinois, or different things in the insurance arena, you know, just different interpretations of similar language that courts have in the 50 states have come out on different issues on different things. You know, the depreciation thing that we covered, there's a lot of issues that, you know, but here it appears uniformity is the rule of the day. And so on these mass kind of viruses, God forbid we get another one, there won't be any challenges because you're wasting your time, I think, as a policyholder, a lot of money.
We'll see. There was a good article in the Law 360 on this. It's good in part because I was quoted in it, but the second half of the article, after there's the victory lap by insurers counsel, myself and Steve Seaman over Hinshaw and Culverson, was policyholder lawyers setting forth why they think they still can, and it's very, you know, they're doing what they have to do, saying, right, you know, that they think that there's a glimmer of getting around what has been uniformity. We'll see. They're not going to stop.
Right.
There's enough at stake for this and future cases that Dan mentions. They're not going to give up. They've got to keep pushing, and
yep,
we'll see what happens. So with that, we'll take our first break and come back with Blaha versus City of Chicago, and it's anything but Blaha.
Right.
We're back for segment 2 of episode 91 of the Podium and Panel podcast, and our second case is Blaha versus City of Chicago. Is a bicyclist riding his own bicycle in a crosswalk a quote, intended and permitted, end quote, user under section 3-102A of the Tort Immunity Act, and thus owed a duty of ordinary care if the location is adjacent to a CTA stop with a Divvy station, but two blocks away from the closest marked bicycle route? That is the question the Illinois Appellate Court First District will answer when it decides Blaha versus City of Chicago that was argued this past week. The plaintiff was injured when his bike hit a pothole in a crosswalk. The trial court dismissed the plaintiff's complaint. For those that are unfamiliar, Divvy is a bike sharing system in Chicago run by Lyft, where the city gains a financial benefit of about $7.5 million per year from the program that plaintiff contended imposed a duty on the city to all bicyclists to properly maintain the crosswalk. For its part, the city argued that Divvy is no different from a bike rack that where the city gains no financial benefit. The plaintiff, who was not even on a Divvy at the time, was not owed a duty of care. This is especially so because riding a bike in a crosswalk is not an intended use of that crosswalk. Crosswalks are for pedestrians, as the name would suggest. Counsel for plaintiff was unable to identify a case one way or another on the issue of a bicycle being ridden in a crosswalk. Dan, tell us about the oral arguments.
Sure, Pat. And for those not familiar, like Pat said, not only with Divvy, but with the Chicago, over the last decade, I would say, there's an increasing amount of bicycle paths on certain streets in Chicago. It can be really a pain because a lot of the bike riders don't use those lanes. But even when they do use the lanes, it can be some very dangerous conditions. A lot of bicyclists get hit by doors and by other things. There's potholes in Chicago. I think we talked about a case early on about another pothole underneath a viaduct or something. And again, I think it was a bike that got went into it and got damaged. And we're here again with legislative intent and kind of legislation and differences in legislation, as Pat and I have talked about several times on this show. And we'll talk about a decision that involved the Constitution and interpretation and usages. But the legislative body in Illinois, like many places, when they amend something, they don't necessarily go through and make it all consistent. And if you ever read, as someone that reads a lot of legislation in the insurance arena and other arenas, when new laws come out, oftentimes all you see is, you know, it's a long omnibus of all the various existing legislative enactments that are amended by the particular situation. And here, one of the sections got amended. And what you often see in the legislative enactment is section so-and-so dot B is deleted in its entirety and replaced with the following language. And then it goes in. As Pat said, you know, the city argued that these Divvy racks are no different than a bike rack. They might have even enhanced that because for those that don't know, Divvy has a fleet of, I don't know, 1,000 bikes, Pat, is it? Something like that in Chicago?
Oh, I don't know. It's I don't know how many. More than that.
Maybe more than that.
There's got to be hundreds of those yeah. stations around the city. And they each have upwards of a dozen bikes.
Yeah. So however many they have, when you take a Divvy bike out, you rent it for a certain amount of money, and then you have to check in periodically and re-put it back into this rack. And so these racks are not like used for the general public. If you had a bike or scooter, you cannot use the Divvy racks because they're magnetized and they're for the particular Divvy bikes. They're all the same make and model and all that. So in any event, there were two provisions of the Illinois Vehicle Act and two interpretations by the party. There was a lot of talk between the appellant and the appellee about rules of construction. And anybody that knows legislative, the specific controls over the more general. The justices on this panel were very inquisitive and reminding the parties and getting concessions that the intent and the rules in Illinois is that whenever there are seemingly inconsistent provisions, the intent is to work on both of them so that they work in harmony, so that we're not canceling legislative enactments. If you could say, well, they're inconsistent, and so this one is knocked out for this purpose, that's not really the intent. What the appellee said when asked was that when there's provisions like this, and they may be inconsistent, then the rule of construction is that the more recent is controlling. And again, this act was amended. as Pat said, the real question here is whether the city owes a duty and what penalties and fines it might face if it doesn't fix these potholes.
Well, the penalty and fine is getting sued.
Right, getting sued, right? And again, the question here is that, that because this divvy stand was right by this subway station, what happens with divvy bikes is that, again, there's these bike lanes in Chicago, but people have to check in at these divvy stations. And so the argument of the plaintiff here is that, that you have to fix and have crosswalks. You can't have potholes in them because those crosswalks are going to be used by divvy bikers following the law to be able to get to the divvy station, lodge their bike, and then leave. And so this person had their own bike, and that was the real question here. Again, a lot of discussion was about the limits and the auto school bus safety code and other provisions that are in Section 208. The appellant argued that again, these provisions were in conflict, that were at issue here. But the Illinois Supreme Court has held that courts' duty to interpret statutes is to avoid inconsistency and address so they work kind of in harmony. One of the interesting things I think that the plaintiff in this case was arguing is that the city, none of its briefing and the trial court never really addressed any of any citing of any precedent that was actually supporting their position. Again, the justices, I think, in this case, really on the appellant side, were really pushing back in terms of kind of, you know, again, the statutory interpretations, these provisions. And so it'll be an interesting case to watch. You know, I'll headline my predictions that the city's probably not responsible for fixing these potholes. But Pat, any thoughts on this case before we...
Well, a couple. First, let me read the section that's at issue. And this is the...
That might be
a helpful. Local public entity, the city of Chicago in this case, has the duty to exercise ordinary care. So this is not a... This is ordinary care. This isn't a heightened duty. This isn't willful and wanton, anything like that. To maintain its property in a reasonably safe condition for the use in the exercise of ordinary care of people whom the entity intended and permitted. That's the key language. So there's no doubt that they are permitted to use.
To permit it, right.
Every inch of road in the city is permitted for a bicycle. That's my commentary, but to continue. To use the property in a manner in which and at such times as it was reasonably foreseeable that it would be used. So there was a lot of discussion at the oral argument about reasonable foreseeability. That's a whole separate inquiry.
Right.
The inquiry is intended and permitted. Reasonable foreseeability is a separate issue.
Right.
There's no doubt that a bike rider is, it's reasonable foreseeable. They're going to use the roads. They're permitted. Are they intended? Now, the intention, the way in which the plaintiff is trying to get to intention is you have this divvy rack.
Right.
And if you're within eyeshot is the best he could draw in terms of a line, then the city had a duty to maintain the road in such a way that the divvy could operate until the person could get to the next marked area. Because there's two ways that bicycle routes are marked in the city, physically on the road and then signs.
Right.
This had neither. And the closest one was a couple blocks away. If that's the rule, then there are huge portions of the city that are not currently marked for bicycle use that are now marked for bicycle use, and Lord knows how you set a bright line for what the city is supposed to maintain with its ordinary care. Eye shot of a divvy is not a line.
Right.
I'm not sure how the court is supposed to tell the city to draw this line, and telling the city that it has to maintain all of the miles of road that are with an eye shot of a divvy to a reasonable care would bankrupt the city. And I'm not exaggerating.
It would.
There are thousands of miles of road in Chicago, according to the record, and about 650 of those miles have been marked for bicycle use, where they've marked bicycle lanes or put up signs. And it's those 650 miles or so that the city is due ordinary care. But given the number of divvy spots, which have got to be in the hundreds. And given that many of them aren't near these marked bicycle lanes, like this one where a CTA stop is. Because, give you an idea, there are 145 CTA stops in the city, and I dare say that the majority of them have a divvy stop next to them. Maybe not all, but I would say a majority of them have a divvy stop near next to them. And so you're talking about huge swaths of the city that the city would now have to maintain in this fashion. They're not only not able to afford it, they're not capable of, that's all the city would do is have to, it'd be great for the people we're going to talk about in the next segment. The road construction guys would be thrilled because that's where they're going to spend all their money is on fixing all the potholes. Because during winter, boy, and then during the spring and fall when the rain, because what causes potholes is rain and snow.
Right.
After a rainstorm, the roads go to shit here in Chicago.
They go to worse shit.
They go to worse. They get much worse. And that's not good. So I just don't know how the city could afford this.
No.
Justice Gordon, who presided over this panel, when it was the opportunity for rebuttal, he said to plaintiff, do you want to argue? Because he's made his mind up. Plaintiff's winning in his mind. The justice who was asking the most questions, really probing, I wasn't sure who, I think it was Justice Ellis.
I think that's right.
I think it was Justice Ellis.
I think he's on that panel, yeah.
He was very, very active on this, trying to figure out about the foreseeability and offering different hypotheticals and whatnot. I'm not sure who the third, was it Justice Paczynski?
I think it may have been.
I'm not sure.
Figuring out, yeah. Sometimes she was they don't not, often tell. So.
Yeah, she was not nearly as active. But Justice Ellis, Justice Gordon made it clear where he stood.
He did.
Justice Ellis was a bit more difficult, but because he was really trying to work this out in his brain.
He was.
And I think counsel for the city, you know, it's hard to make the kind of policy argument I just made, but that's really what's behind this.
It is.
It's the whole point of the Tort Immunity Act in the first instance is not to bankrupt municipalities. We'll see what happens in this. Very interesting situation.
An interesting second issue that I forgot to mention, Pat, is that there was a substitution of judge motion, and then there was a motion to dismiss hearing, and the appellant was saying that a motion to dismiss is not a true hearing that would prevent you from being able to substitute judge. And in rebuttal, for whatever reason, he decided to waive, and Justice Gordon, I think, asked him, are you sure? You know, are you relinquishing the substitution of judge? And he said, yeah, we're done with that. So for whatever reason, who knows? But
I'm not sure what that's all about. So there we are. So we'll take our next break and come back with our third segment and just cover a bunch of cases, because there were a bunch that came out this week that we've covered on the show that we need to talk about.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
Segment 3 of episode 91 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. And as we mentioned at the outset, we don't have a third case, but we've got plenty of predictions sure to go wrong. But first, we'll go into business interruption for COVID. And as we talked about in the first segment, it continues as we've discussed at the appellate level pretty unanimously, finding for insurers. And an important development, as we mentioned in the first segment as well, the first state Supreme Court has spoken on the issue and ruled in favor of the insurer. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court in Vervine versus Strathmore ruled that there was not coverage under these circumstances. And again, for the same things we talked about in the first case and in the first segment, you know, no property damage or loss to property. And so, you know, no physical presence. And so that's a big step. We've got still Wisconsin, Ohio.
And Iowa came out with two decisions on Friday that right. were favorable to the insurer.
Right.
I want to add one more thing to Strathmore. If you remember the argument, there was also a claim brought against the broker because right. of the three plaintiffs, one or two had virus exclusions, but the other one didn't.
Right.
And the court dealt with the claim against the broker with very short shrift. And it didn't need more. It just said, claim of the brand, the broker doesn't survive because we didn't reach the virus exclusion. There was no coverage in the first instance. The virus exclusion or its absence didn't play a role here. Broker, you're out. Yep. So that was, it didn't take long for them. It's like a sentence, maybe right. two
right.
in the opinion. Because right. I was waiting to see what they were going to do with the broker because there was very little argument about it right. at the oral argument. And now we know.
Right.
They basically there's not coverage, so in the first instance, so the absence or the presence of the virus exclusion doesn't matter. Case closed vis-a-vis the broker.
Right.
And there was an Eighth Circuit decision, Dan. You were going to tell us about.
Yeah. It's a second Missouri decision last week, and again summarily, found for the same reasons they found in prior cases that there's no coverage. Gentlemen's Club also lost its case. I forget what state that was in. And for a bad pun, policyholders appear to be stripped of their chances of prevailing. And why not?
That is a very bad pun, but we like those. We like those here on the Podium and Panel podcast.
We do.
Just as we like to screw with our algorithm on prediction sure to go wrong, we like bad puns.
Right. And speaking of prediction sure to go wrong, as Pat and I mentioned, we got a lot of decisions to cover. And so we're now 131 and a half, 21 and a half.
132 and a half.
132. Yeah, I forgot to fix that for Kassir. Yep. And Pat's 131 and a half, 22 and a half, and 7. We still have a one case gap, and we've got a couple of differences in the last couple of weeks. So that will surely
sounds like based on what you said, we may have another one out there. So we'll see.
Well, we'll see. We got to write the Illinois Appellate Court Second District in Daniels versus Venta. This is the case that a plaintiff could state a cause of action against the defendants for exposing him to asbestos. And so for those that are not that familiar, asbestos cases have been going on for 60 years, maybe. Some 50s maybe they started. I don't know, 50s, 60s, 70s. But it's the gift that will never stop giving to lawyers and plaintiffs. So,
well, I don't think it's giving much to the plaintiffs. They're
not
dying.
It's not.
But yeah. The lawyers are benefiting.
The lawyers are benefiting for sure.
The case held that they could go after the exclusive remedy of the Workers' Compensation Act did not apply because they were asking him to undertake an illegal activity to remove asbestos when he was not a licensed asbestos remover right. under Illinois law. We'll see if that gets expanded beyond this circumstance, which is one of the risks that counsel for the defendants pointed out. We'll see if they expand
yep.
that.
Yep.
The next case. So on Thursday, the Illinois Supreme Court released 10 decisions, four of which we've covered on the show. So why don't we just go in order of which I listed them on when I posted them.
Sure. Do you want to talk about McQueen?
McQueen versus Green. Boy, this is the case where we talked about this all the way back on episode 31. So 60 episodes ago to the number, we talked about this case. That's an old one.
Oh.
They took a while to get this one. It's a unanimous decision. And in this case, the other ones aren't unanimous, maybe in the outcome, but not in the reasoning. But there's dissents in at least two of the other ones we're going to talk about. And one is a special concurrence in Schultz that really is a dissent. But right. we'll get there. So McQueen, the employee was found not liable, but his employer was found liable to the tune of $1 million in punitive damages. And the appellate court reversed and said, that makes no sense. the Supreme Court reversed that. So no, that's fine, because the claims against the employer were not derivative claims. They were direct claims for negligent hiring, retaining, supervision, and training. And therefore, those claims could stand alone. They didn't rise or fall based upon the admitted respondeat, the agency relationship, respondeat superior, between the employee and the employer. And therefore, those claims stood. Now, I can tell you, this is going to raise all kinds of problems in allocation. Right. And the rules are just not prepared for this, I don't think. We're going to see how this works out. This is a very unique case where it was possible, reasonable, to find that the employee was not at fault, but that the employer was. That's a unique set of facts, and maybe a situation where bad facts make bad law, or in this case, unique facts make bad law. We'll see what happens there.
We got that wrong.
We did get that one wrong.
Yeah.
And then Robinson versus Sauk Village, we got this one right. We discussed the oral argument on episode 77, but we also had in one of the episodes in the teens when we covered this on the at the appellate court, we got this one right. This is the police chase case that ranged over into Indiana, and the Supreme Court went so far as to overrule Townsend versus City of Chicago.
Yep.
So in Robinson, the court held that they didn't quite get the driver. They didn't have him in custody. Simply halfway surrounding him wasn't good enough. And in overruling Townsend, they said having cops on either side of the vehicle as the person got into the front seat of the vehicle from the back seat and drove away, that also didn't place him directly under their custody, as had been the finding of the appellate court in the Townsend case. So a very interesting development there. And you're going to see police chases, I guess, take on a different character. They're going to box these guys in.
Right.
You're going to have to get them physically under control in order for them to. And I'm not sure that's going to make anybody any safer.
Well, I was just thinking that, Pat. I think it exposes the police to, you know, potential shootings or using the cars to try to, you know, batter the way out. I mean,
but yeah. The other option is to have him drive, you know, mow down poor Mr. Javier Robinson.
Right.
And so maybe the real solution is here. If you're chasing after a stolen car, maybe not the 100-mile-an-hour police chase through the south suburbs is such a hot idea.
Right.
Maybe just don't do a chase. I mean, if you're chasing a murderer, that's one thing. If you're chasing some guy that stole a car, and in this case gets out of a car and gets into another one and steals another one, maybe the property. No, on the stealing of the property. I have a case, I think I probably mentioned when we discussed this case, where the guy tried to pass a forged check and they chased him down. It's a case that happened in Little Rock, Arkansas. And they chased the guy down. And as they're chasing him, he gets into an accident, kills two people, including himself. It's like, really? It was for a $10,000 check and he didn't even get the 10 grand. Really, we're going to chase someone down over it, it's money, it's property. Maybe we shouldn't chase people for that. As I say, if it's a murderer, a rapist, okay, I get that. But we're talking about property crime here. Yeah, you shouldn't do property crimes, but maybe we shouldn't chase them down either.
Right.
Bad stuff happens. We'll see. Which brings us to Illinois Road versus County of Cook. And this drew a dissent from Justice Tice, but it was a reversal in favor of the road construction plaintiffs,
right,
who said that, hey, you're misusing the allocation of the allocation of road taxes that you're collecting. You've got to put this money towards building roads.
And this was a constitutional provision.
It's a constitution. It's in the Illinois Constitution. The people voted on it. It's a big dispute over that. We're going to have John Fitzgerald, who represented the plaintiffs, appellants, on the show to talk more about the case, because it's a pretty technical case. And as I said, drew a dissent, and you could tell she was going to dissent, Justice Tice, at the oral argument, that where maybe not that she was going to dissent, but that where her view was of the case at oral argument.
Right.
And she was, now we know, trying to get her colleagues to go along with her, and she was unsuccessful in that effort.
And we talked extensively about that on episode 76 when we discussed the case. that she was, you know, we were trying to figure out where she was going. And like you said, it's obvious that she was trying to get some colleagues to come along with her, and did not happen.
Didn't happen for her. Which brings us to Schultz versus St. Clair County, which has the special concurrence of Justice Garmon, joined by Justice Burke. That's Michael Burke, not Chief Justice Burke. That really is a dissent. Dan, do you want to tell us about Schultz versus St. Clair County?
Sure. This was a case of tort immunity, and the circuit court had dismissed it.
By the way, that's our third tort immunity case of the day. Robinson's a tort immunity case. This is a tort immunity case. Blaha's a tort immunity case.
Right. And what happened here was that the Circuit Court of St. Clair County found that Section 4-102 of the Tort Immunity Act provided absolute immunity for plaintiff's claims, and that the decedent's conduct was the sole proximate cause of her death. The appellate court affirmed. And then the court actually said that the limited immunity, not of Section 15-1A, of the ETS Act governed the claim, but they affirmed the dismissal because in this case, again, unique facts, the decedent's conduct was the proximate cause of his death, so it didn't matter whether it's tort immunity.
She was drunk and she went into a ditch and died, right. And that's on her, not on the, you know, no matter what the police did, it was a condition versus cause situation as opposed, and so they held that there was no proximate cause.
And a reminder, this is a case where the lady was at a gas station, convenience station. Her husband called the police, and then, eventually she was found in the ditch, as Pat said. She had left the service station. The police did not go there in time, and so you had a tragic situation. But as we talked about, you know, it was her conduct and.
The dissent is,
it is.
And what Justice Garmon says is all this stuff in this opinion about the interaction between the ETS Act and the Tort Immunity Act that deals with the section of the Tort Immunity Act we're talking about is a section that says that the local municipalities don't have a duty to provide police services.
Right.
And then the ETS Act talks about a limited immunity for having a bad dispatching system. And the court said the limited immunity of the dispatch system applies, the more specific controls over the more general. Justice Garmon's like, that's all dicta, because none of that was essential for your ruling. Who cares? That's an advisory opinion. It should be completely ignored. The opinion should be limited to the causation analysis that the court held. That's the end of the story. Very short opinion. Don't tell me about the other thing. Right. And then she goes on to say why she thinks their analysis of the interaction between the Tort Immunity Act and the ETS Act is wrong.
Right.
That's why I say it's a dissent. She agrees in the judgment, but she's like, everything else in that opinion should be either ignored or is wrong, or both. She's a little worked up. Right. That's not what I mean. She's got a very, I don't think she's wrong.
I don't either.
Because it's not necessary for the holding.
Right.
I don't know why they said it. Providing clarity, sure, but they're not supposed to do that.
No. And again, it will cause problems at a later date when some other case that has different facts, they'll cite to this case, right? And it'll be...
And someone's going to say it's all dicta. Look at you.
Right. Yeah.
It's all dicta.
And we got that
Which brings
wrong
us
well.
To... I'm sorry?
We got Schultz wrong.
We got Schultz wrong. No, we got Schultz right. We did get Schultz wrong. That's right. I'm sorry. Yeah.
And Vervine, the Massachusetts case that we talked about earlier in the BI, we got that right. We predicted that. And then in Kassir,
Kassir versus Thyssen Bonamisa, the Baron, and the Art. A unanimous opinion. Not surprising. We played the segment when we did this on the show of Justice Kagan asking. Counsel for the appellee, don't you want to treat this foreign entity as very special when we just got done telling us we don't have to treat them as special? And the court held that in a situation where you've got a claim under the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, and it's a state law claim, you use state law principles of choice of law to pick. And this is the case where David Boies represents the appellant, and this piece of expropriated art of Cezanne that was taken from these folks that were leaving Germany after the Nazis took over. The cost of leaving was the Cezanne. It shows up at this art museum in Madrid. As it turns out, it may not matter, the choice of law, because even California choice of law may choose Spanish law. And if it chooses Spanish law under this goofy rule that Spain has, if it's held openly for 6 years, as this apparently was, it's essentially an adverse possession, and they can take good title even against someone who had it thieved, as was the case here. So we'll see what happens, but an interesting case. But at least we know that there's not federal common law in this area. In all the other areas, there's common law, federal common law, but not here.
Oh, come on. There is no federal common law.
Of course not.
The biggest laugh in all of law.
Exactly. So let's do our prediction, sure to go wrong, for this week, Dan.
Okay.
What do you think? I think Windy City, that's affirmed.
I think it's affirmed.
Okay. Now that brings us to Blaha. Blaha versus City. So the city won at the trial court level. Yeah. Are they going to win at the appellate court?
I think they win at the appellate court.
There's going to be a dissent from Justice Gordon.
I think there is, but again, the intended, as you mentioned, I'm not sure that all these bicyclists are intended, but.
Well, they're all permitted. Are they intended? I think there's going to be a reversal. I think Justice Gordon is going to prevail on Justice Ellis, and I think the third justice is Justice Paczynski, that I don't know how they draw the bright line. I don't think they care. Right. I think the city is going to lose this one, even though I don't think they should. I think they're going to lose this one. So,
and if they do, we'll see it at the Supreme Court.
Maybe. Which brings us to the rule of the week, Dan, which is a nugget you pulled out from our LinkedIn friend, Corey Webster. Tell us about the rule of the week.
Yeah, I think it's from Corey Webster, although it may have just come to me via Twitter, so I don't recall now. But it's and it may have been Corey, because Corey posts a lot of interesting things about interactions of appellate courts and things.
He does.
This one comes to us via the Fifth Circuit. There was a recent case, and I don't have the site, apologies, but a 47-year veteran of the court's bar petitioned for a rehearing. He did not like the decision that came down from the three-person panel. He wrote that, quote, "The opinion of the court is so deficient that it cannot be the product of three veteran justices on the panel," end quote, and that the staff attorney's office must have written it. Let's just say the panel was not kind in its order. Like saying, with all due respect, the rule is simple. Do not attack the judiciary or the staff in your motions for reconsideration or on any briefs you file. And he was warned in all caps of his transgressions, and that future behavior like this could result in him being removed from that court's bar. And so, again, just the and the justices were judges in that case, because courts of appeals are not justices, as Judge Bauer. Were very, very off put.
Not none too. They were very put out, shall we say?
Sure.
To quote, I believe, The Princess Bride. They were very put out.
And there you have it.
So with that, we'll take our leave. Thank you very much for joining the Podium and Panel podcast. We'll see you next week.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.